Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It's a blessing to be here. We're honored. Sarah is, I don't think she's here quite yet. She's with her. Good morning, Sarah. Sarah, Ron, and I share part of the responsibility of being board members at Central Florida Bible Camp, something that's very near and dear to our heart. We volunteer a lot of time and our efforts and money, and we're going to hear a little bit about that in Bible class. But as we were coming, we're told that if we're teaching class and telling about camp, we've got a couple lessons we got to teach too. So here I am. Years ago, I used to teach a teen class, and years ago I was substituting them after I had finished, stopped teaching them, and someone else took over. And as I was teaching them, I saw a lot of blank faces. And blank faces are not what you want to see when you're teaching kids about something as important as, you know, the Bible. And so I stopped the lesson, asked them what's going on. I finally drug out of them and we saw this in COVID quite obviously, that they're teaching stuff in our schools that the kids really shouldn't, we really don't want our kids as Christians to be learning. And so one of the things they had trouble with is they loved their parents and they had grown up in the church, they professed to believe in God, and yet their teachers had confused them to the point where they weren't sure what to believe. They didn't want to ask their parents. They didn't want to get their parents upset. But they would ask their teachers, the ones that they trusted. And, of course, the answers they got were just astounding. The teachers would say, well, there's a difference between science and the Bible, and the two don't mesh. And the Bible's the Christianity, the God of the Jews, the God of and Christ of Christians. It's just a myth, just kind of like the Greeks and the Romans. And of course, they were just confused. They never said anything to anybody until this class, and we finally discovered it. So I put my lesson away. I luckily had my laptop. I pulled it out, and we started talking about Christian evidences. It's something very near and dear to my heart. In fact, you're in the front row. I apologize if I start spitting, it gets on you. I get excited about this stuff. I really enjoy it. And what happened in the classroom, we need to get our young people. We need a foundation. All of us need some help building a foundation to strengthen our faith. But we especially need to give that to our young people. Our young people need to know that there is a God above. He is the creator. He is the designer. They need to know that the Bible is something that you can trust. It's not just a fable. It's not a book of fables. In fact, you can trust all of it. That there was a Jesus, a man named Jesus the Christ. He did come to this earth. He did die. And the only way that we're going to have a chance of salvation is by reading the Bible and doing what it says. So, we started with the class with, you only have two choices. There's no third choice in this. Either we're here by design, there is a creator, he thought about this, he designed it all, he put it in place, or we're here by accident, meaning evolution. There's not a third choice. I'm not one that believes at all that God used evolution to create the world. It actually would take a much larger miracle, a whole series of miracles for that to happen. We'll go over some of that a little bit today. But there's only two choices. Either we're here by accident or we're here by design. I'm going to skip over a few slides just in the interest of time. In Psalms 19, David, I believe he probably wrote this when he was a shepherd, or at least remembering when he was a shepherd. Is that big enough for you guys to read? I wasn't sure what font size I needed, but hopefully this is big enough. In Psalms 19, it's obvious that David was writing this, at least remembering the time when he was a shepherd. Because when you're a shepherd, you're out in the sky, in the nature, you're looking at the skies, you're looking at the things around you. And this is one of the things he wrote. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the works of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they display knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into all the earth, their words into the ends of the world. Very poetic way of saying it's obvious that there is a creator. It's obvious that somebody put some thought into this design that we see and that we enjoy, and that it spreads to everything in our lives. Romans 1 verse 20, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. The writer of this gospel, God inspired and told people that you don't have an excuse. These are God's inspired words. You don't have an excuse. Even if you're not taught the truth, even if you never meet a missionary, even if you never are taught who God is and what Christ is, you don't have an excuse, because you can look around you, and just like David did as a shepherd, you can see that things are have an order to them. Things are very sophisticated. I love to talk about this one, but I'm going to skip over it. I'll just say that this is a made-up thing. There's a lot of things that evolutionists use that are just made up. They're fabricated. They're not true. In fact, a lot of them are made just as a thought, just as a theory. And of course, they've been proven false, and this is simply one of them. And this is something we still see in our history books, our textbooks, our museums even. It's amazing that we still see this, but it's been proven untrue. There's a lot like that. If you believe in evolution, dinosaurs are the poster child of evolution. In fact, every time you talk about evolution, they usually have a picture of a dinosaur on the front cover of whatever brochure they've got. Well, when my kids were still young, they're grown and gone now, but when my kids were still young, we took a trip to Glen Rose, Texas, because Glen Rose, Texas, years before, had a flood go through, and it washed out part of the riverbank and exposed some dinosaur and footprints of man. Now, in the historical chart, in the evolutionary chart of evolution, dinosaurs were here hundreds of millions of years ago. Man is a fairly recent concept, a million to maybe 3 million years old, so there's a big gap in between. But if you have any historical evidence that shows that dinosaurs and man were actually on this planet at the same time, you kind of blow evolution out of the water. That, like I say, it's their poster child. So in Glen Rose, Texas, when the riverbank washed out, it exposed an old riverbed that had dinosaur tracks and man's footprints there in the same level of layer of dirt that had turned to stone. The bottom right-hand picture is a close-up of a human foot, human putting their foot next to a human footprint. And the one on the bottom left is actually a cast of something that was out there, and they've actually sent this cast to experts and said, they didn't send it to Christian scientists, they sent it to people that were agnostics. And they said, would this be something that you could show to be valid? And they looked at it in several different ways. One way is the dinosaur footprint, when it steps down, of course it's so heavy, it would displace the footprint of the human. And it didn't just cover it, but it displaced the mud that was in it. So there's five different aspects that show that this is not an example of fraud. Whenever these things were first exposed, atheists would say, well, someone fabricated those things. And when I heard that, I started laughing, giggling to myself, because can you imagine somebody there with a little chisel making all these footprints and then making it look like it eroded the way it did? So it was a fascinating example of the fact that men and dinosaurs were here together. And of course, this is just one of many examples. Another example we have of existence between dinosaurs and men knowing each other is the Aztecs. When they started going and digging up the Aztec artifacts, they found pottery is just one example. You can see on the bottom right, can you tell what that is? Are your eyes good enough to be able to see what that is? That's a Triceratops. The funny thing I like about this is they show a man riding that Triceratops. On the lower left, it's a little harder to distinguish, but on the bottom of the vase, and with its head pointing up and then pointed back over itself, is another picture of a dinosaur. Aztecs also had figurines, pottery figurines that they made. And of course, they had other animals that they showed in real life that we still have. But they also showed dinosaurs. A lot of the figurines, and there's hundreds of these things. There's not just a few. There's hundreds of these things that they've uncovered. And these figurines are obviously displaying the fact that there is dinosaurs. So man knew dinosaurs. In the 1990s, they started really pulling out a lot of artifacts out of Siberia, the frozen tundra in Siberia, in Russia. And the people, I can't remember the name of the people there, but it's kind of like our Eskimos. Now, they have a certain name, and they would find woolly mammoth tusks by the thousands, and they'd bring them in, and that's how they helped supplement their income. But one time, a young hunter boy was out, and he found two tusks sticking out, and it was attached to a mammoth. The whole thing was there. That's a full-grown mammoth in that photo. Do you see? Well, yeah. That's a full-grown mammoth in the photo. That's a big block of ice. And the American group of American scientists went over and dug it out, chipped it out, and then Russia gave them a frozen cave to store it in. It's still being studied to this day. But there's something very funny about this mammoth. Not only was it intact, Here's another example of a woolly mammoth. It still had skin. It still had muscles. It had soft tissue, sinews. It still had hair. And there's a third example there up that shows in the grass that they had had deteriorated to the point, but that the skin and the hair are still there. Now, there's a little funny thing about this. I see most of you have a little bit of age on you like I do. When we were children, they taught that mammoths were a little younger than dinosaurs. Dinosaurs were hundreds of millions of years old. Mammoths were a little young, but not much. And then man was separated by, 100 million years, because man is a fairly new concept as far as evolutionists go. But the mammoth would not last that long, certainly not their skin, their soft tissues, their hair, but they have example after example. This is just two or three examples of it. The other problem is if you froze this, once water freezes, the nice thing about in Siberia, you had the mud covering, which a lot of reason we have dinosaurs, the mud covers the bodies, and of course we have the bones to study and examine. But in the mammoth's case, it was covered by mud and water, and then it froze once the water started receding. I believe it was done at the time of the flood. And once the water's receding, that area froze and stayed frozen. Well, there's something that if you study the science of freezing, our freezers maybe get to 18 degrees below 0 Celsius, but water, once it gets to 0 degrees Celsius or negative 32 degrees Fahrenheit, it doesn't get any colder. And when you get that cold, it does stop some of the deterioration, but it doesn't stop all the way. There's still a little bit of heat, and it still continues to deteriorate. In fact, if you've ever frozen fish or meats in your freezer and come back years later, you've forgotten about it and come back years later, thaw it out, it's not worth eating. So if you expand that thought to of course, your freezers are much colder than water freezing, but if you expand that thought to thousands of years, scientists have shown that these mammoths that they found probably wouldn't last but a few thousand years, which again correlates with the time that we're calling it the flood. So if you look at the evolutionary chart, that mammoth that used to be down there by the dinosaurs, they now show it up here where man is. They show it as a contemporary of man. So evolution it continues to fall apart. Evolution also teaches that the earth is ancient, very old, millions of years old. And it may be, but God created it that way. But they think that the layers in the earth as they dig down are millions of, or even hundreds of millions of years old. But one of the problems with that is what we see here in this photo. The top photo shows a real tree on the far left, and then three fossilized trees, and those three fossilized trees go through several different strata. There's an example of it on the bottom right. That's a replica of it, and it better shows those layers. But if those layers are millions of years or hundreds of millions of years old, that tree wouldn't exist except for maybe in one strata. So it displaces the idea that the evolution was done in a very slow, progressive method. And there's many examples of polystrate fossils, as we call them, that show that these levels can't have happened in slow, progressive ways. It actually probably happened all at once. You may remember from your biology classes, history classes, about a man named Copernicus. Copernicus was the first man that thought of the idea or introduced the idea that everything didn't revolve around the Earth, including the sun and the universe, but the Earth revolved around the sun, and then we didn't really hold a special place in the universe. We actually do. But it wasn't the center of the universe. And a lot of people thought that made us mediocre. When we were the center of the universe, that made us prepare something very special. But when we're not the center of the universe, that makes us mediocre. They developed the principle of mediocrity, which actually helps develop a lot of the sciences after that. But he didn't mean to be that way. He wanted to show the specialness of creation. And indeed, in the 1970s, when we started exploring space and we shot out one of the Voyagers, it was Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. Voyager 1 got to the edge of the galaxy, turned around, and shot a picture of the Earth. And you probably can't see it from there, but there's a little tiny white dot where that arrow points. That's the Earth. And people thought, well, that's an example of how mediocre the Earth really is. But the Earth is nothing but special. It is there's something very special about our Earth. It's built exactly the way we need it. T.S. Eliot once wrote, "We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." So all the things that we learned throughout the years, we go back and look at what we looked at the very beginning. And that's what science does. You go back and look at the beginning, you look at it with new eyes. And so the idea that the Earth is meteoric, we go back and look at it through new eyes, we find that it's extremely special. And we're going to go over just a couple of those specialness things today. The Earth and everything we have around us has to be very specific. There is a design to this thing. It has to be very specific or else life would cease to exist. The very fact that the Earth rotates in 24 hours is very specific. The fact that the sun is a certain distance away and a certain size is very specific. The very fact that the sun, how the sun burns, very specific. If any of those were different, we'd actually heat up too much and burn up, or we'd freeze to death. So if the sun is a little further away or a little smaller, we would actually not warm up in that 24-hour period like we should. So these things are in perfect balance. They're made exactly to be exactly right. Gravitational pull. It holds in our atmosphere. But it also, if the Earth spun a little faster, we'd probably go flying off into space. Or if our gravity was a little less, we'd go flying off into space. That wouldn't be a good thing. But if it's a little stronger, a little heavier, we'd have a hard time walking. So gravity is, again, just the right amount. Atmosphere, the balance that we have between nitrogen and oxygen and other things, it's perfect for life here on Earth. If we had anything different, life would not be able to sustain here on Earth. And it also protects us from the sun's UV rays. We get UV rays, we can go to the beach and get sunburned, but if the atmosphere didn't deflect most of the UV rays, we'd start cooking like in a microwave. So the sun's UV rays, and of course there's many other things, we're just kind of skimming the surface, a lot of this stuff, just introducing the idea of what some evidence is that are out there, but there's a lot more information that's out there. The moon. People look at the moon and think it's not all that special. But the moon helps us stay on our axis, helps us on our rotation around the sun, but it also helps our seas. If the moon was any closer or bigger, our seas would be, our ocean would have tidal waves, so that our land would actually eventually just disappear. It wouldn't have any soil to plant anything on. But if it was a little smaller and further away, the seas would actually die. The moon helps us churn up the ocean to give the fish in the ocean the oxygen that they need, that they breathe through their gills. So again, the moon and the relationship between the Earth and the moon is just perfect. I don't know if you ever heard of a gentleman named Lee Strobel, very popular in the Christian evidence movement. Lee Strobel, if you don't know, used to be a newspaperman, and he his wife became a Christian, started hanging around Christian women and an example of what we should do to reach out those around us, invite them into our group. So his wife became a Christian, and he set out to prove that there was no God so he can get, as he's put it in his book, get my fishing buddy back, because he wanted to go fishing. So he set out to prove there is no God. He went to different scientists. He started out with his high school teachers and found out what they had taught him wasn't quite honest. So then he went to scientists around the world, not just Christian scientists, although he did do that, but he went to atheistic scientists because he was an atheist. He was trying to prove this thing with the Bible to be incorrect. And he just looked at 13 aspects of our world and found out they were in perfect balance. And so he started asking the question, if this was a little different, what's the chances of this happened by accident? And just looking at gravity, the chances of gravity being just right for life, to sustain life here on Earth, the chances of it being here by accident are one chance in 10 to the 27th power, or so 27 zeros after a 10. That's a billion, billion, billion. Scientists, when you go into the higher levels of math, you'll find that scientists never say something's impossible. They say it's so improbable, it's probably never going to happen. So you can show it through math how it's probably never going to happen, because the chances of it ever happening are just so remote, it's safe to say it's impossible. That number is approaching that number. But when you put all 13 of them together, as he did in the video, that number is, much like the next slide where we talk about DNA, one chance in 10 to the 2 millionth power, something in that range. There's 2 million zeros. Only God knows what number that is. But it far surpasses the chances of us happening everything we need on earth to survive and have sustained life here on earth. It shows that it's very impossible. And that's only 13. Here's a bunch more. Here's a few more. We're not going to go over those. And this is the other thing I was talking about. Lee Strobel went to talk about DNA. Our Christian scientists we have some videos out there that show, that really go into the depth. I mean, it's put you to sleep at the depth they go into it. Talking about DNA and the... I think I just lost it. Am I back? I got a red light.
Okay.
We'll keep going then. I'll talk louder. We have a lot of Christian scientists that when they look at DNA, and again, this study is probably 20, 25 years old, they found the chances of DNA being just right to keep life going in this world is 1 × 10^2 millionth power. So one chance in 1 in 2 million zeros behind it. It's impossible. And like I say, this study was 20 or 25 years ago. They have since, I just watched a video preparing for this lesson, and I'm not going to present it, but I'll tell you a little bit about what it's about. They're finding that it's not just the DNA strands that come together, different proteins that come together that build who we are. There's so much more to it. There's actually a water. They gave the water some specific name, but that water that surrounds it, all of those protein pieces, help give it power, help make it work. It's not just the strands, but how do they know how to work, and what gives them the power, the energy to keep going? And there's that water that somehow is keeping that thing going, and there's much more to it. They went into some depth, but I would love to go into depth. We just don't have time today. But DNA and many other things just show that evolution, it's just impossible. Mathematically, it's just impossible. And these numbers are not from Christians that decide these numbers. These are from people that don't believe in God. Atheistic scientists that used to believe in evolution, used to teach evolution, they no longer teach it. They no longer believe it. Some of them have become Christians. The majority of them have not. They just refuse to believe that there is a deity out there. Symbiotic relationships. What time did I start? I didn't look. Symbiotic relationships. And I'm just going to breeze through this one. Symbiotic relationships are where animals and plants or different animals have a relationship that they benefit each other, they help each other. There's just a few examples. You probably heard of one or two of those up there. There's fungus that helps plants grow. This one I thought was interesting. Eels, moray eels, you wouldn't think that they'd allow something to crawl in their mouth. They just chomp down on it because it's food. But they will allow shrimp to come clean their teeth. I guess they don't want to get dentures in their old age. We have a symbiotic relationship with a great many things, and especially plants. We use plants for oxygen. We use trees to build our houses. We eat many different types of plants out there, and we use them for our herbs, and we use them for our medication. So what a coincidence that we are here on Earth and we have what we need. There is a design to it. It's not a coincidence. But there's many symbiotic relationships that are not just mutually beneficial. They are mutually dependent on each other. And if you think about it, some of these things disprove evolution all by themselves. Almost every animal, just about everything in the ocean, just about everything on land has a male and female. And without a male and female, the species would disappear. They wouldn't exist anymore. If you only had one male, what are you going to do? Some people today believe that males can get pregnant. Don't ask me where they got that idea. But if you didn't have a male and female, and they didn't evolve at exactly the same time and exactly the same rate, they wouldn't exist. Animals and plants, same thing. If you didn't have plants to give us oxygen and animals to give CO2 back to the plants, they wouldn't last long. One or the other would suffocate. The animal food chain. We're going to talk about in the next little bit about where a lot of evolutionists believe the smaller creatures develop first and then the larger predators develop later, and that theory doesn't work either. We'll talk about that in just a second. Humans and what we call gut bacteria, if we didn't have something in our intestinal tract that actually breaks down the food that we eat
it would come out the same way it went in. We wouldn't have any nutrients out of it, and we'd literally starve to death, even though we'd eat like crazy. Bees and flowering plants, a lot of plants flower. But if you didn't have something to carry that pollen from plant to plant, those plants would die out. And, of course, the bees wouldn't have anything to live on. If the harder you look at life, the easier it is to see how absolutely dependent we are on other things in this earth. Now, it wasn't just the earth and the design on the earth. It's the plants and the animals and how we react with each other. It's absolutely critical. Yellowstone National Park, before the turn of the century, they reintroduced wolves back into the park. You might remember this is very controversial. Some ranchers that actually used some of the park to raise their cattle were up in arms about it. I mean, literally, they're talking about shooting them. But they were protected, and they brought in the ecologist convinced the park to bring the wolves back in for a reason. They had an overabundance of deer. The deer were actually becoming an ecological issue. So they introduced wolves, and indeed they did. The wolves did call out some of the deer, but they didn't call out as much as they would like. So the deer were still a problem, except they had an effect on the deer that they didn't expect. The deer started hiding. The deer would, before the wolves were introduced, foxes were the main predator out there, and the foxes aren't big enough to take down a deer. So the deer would live out in the open, eat the grass. Of course, when it rained, there's no roots there, no grass there to keep the soil from washing into the river. The river was getting out of control. All sorts of things were becoming a problem there. And that's in what I was talking about before. The smaller animals, the things that eat plants and stuff, and that goes with the rats and the rabbits and everything like that, those smaller ones would grow to a point where our ecology wouldn't survive. They'd eat us out of house and home, and rats especially is something that you can imagine how bad that would be. But the deer started hiding. And when the deer started hiding, even though the wolves didn't kill them off, the deer started hiding, and the plants, the grasslands, were allowed to grow. Something they didn't expect is the trees grew up to five times more because somehow the deers in the area have eaten all the grass, took the nutrients away, so the trees were affected. So the trees started going up to five times faster once the wolves were reintroduced. Well, you get a lot of trees, you get a lot of birds. All the birds started coming back. All the small animals started coming back because when the wolves came in, the foxes were displaced. And so the mice and the rabbits and the other squirrels, other small animals started coming back because the foxes weren't there to kill them and eat them. The beavers started coming back. The beavers did what they did. They built dams or darns, I guess you'd say in church. And the fish started coming back. The frogs started coming back. The turtles started coming back. The salamanders and all sorts of aquatic life started coming back. So the whole ecology just mushroomed. Of course, the rabbits and the mice started coming back, and oddly enough, they thought that the foxes would kind of be culled out as well because the wolves were back reintroduced, and of course they're the main predator. But when those small animals started coming back, the foxes actually had more food to eat, and so the fox population started to expand. Of course, other predators started coming back: eagles, hawks, vultures, crows, all sorts of things like that. And so the whole ecology changed and blossomed. Now, if that's not design, I don't know what is. The other unintended effect is the rivers. The rivers were being washed out whenever they had a rain. The gullies would wash in, and the rivers were starting to go wild, washing out trees. Trees were falling in, and the rivers actually came back the way they were designed, the way they were originally, the path they originally had, and they actually straightened out so that they were very happy with it. So, again, the whole idea teaches that there is a hierarchy that God has put in place. Without this hierarchy in place, from the very beginning, it just wouldn't all work. And that's where I don't believe that God used evolution, because it would take a bigger arm of God to make that work than it would just to breathe it into existence. So there is a designer, there is a creation. In 1 Peter 3:15, but in your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. You guys are all Christians. I know that you probably don't need a lesson like this, but at the very least, it will help give you a foundation to sustain your faith. But at the very least, it might also help when you go to talk to other people. I had a, just came back from Thanksgiving. Love Thanksgiving. Love getting together with family. But my niece had married a young man who wasn't a Christian, much to the dismay of my sister and her husband. And he had started to come to church for a while, but then he stopped because, he didn't grow up in a good home. He had no idea what the truth really is. He hasn't been taught the truth at all. And so he doesn't know what to believe. He doesn't really believe in evolution, but he doesn't really believe in God. And so once he told me that, when I was there for Thanksgiving, I had been preparing for this, and of course, he just opened up. So I can't wait to get back to him and share with him some of the Christian evidence. But that's what all this is for. It's not only to give us a foundation of our own and for our children, but it's to give us a little ammo so that whenever we do have a chance to speak, you start quoting the Bible and they're lost. They don't believe in the Bible. So why bother listening to you about what the Bible has to say? If they do, great. But if you need something a little bit more substantial as far as proofs of the Bible, proofs of God, proofs of design, then you have a little bit of that. The last thing I wanted to talk about is a story. You may have heard of the story or read the book, watched the movie Mutiny on the Bounty. Mutiny on the Bounty is a true story. Bounty was a ship. Captain Bligh was its captain. Captain, he was not a nice guy. He was a tough man. They had gone to, I think it was Tahiti, to load up some bread plants, and they were going to transport them back and plant them back in England. So they went to Tahiti, they were there for several months planting all these plants so they'd have enough to put on the ship and come and bring back. Well, while they were there, the sailors fell in love with the native women. So they didn't want to leave, but they were under contract, they had to leave or else they would literally be hung. That's considered mutiny. Well, on the way back, they had a limited amount of water. And of course, plants have to have water, especially when they're at sea. And men have to have water, oddly enough. And so Captain Bligh decided the plants were more important than the men, and he was willing to let some of the men die. And he made the rules very strict. Well, one man apparently was about to pass out from lack of water, and he went and took a drink that he wasn't supposed to. And the captain was going to have him keel-hauled. Now, keel-hauling is when they tie a rope at both ends and just drag you under the ship. It usually kills you. If you don't drown, you get torn to death by all the barnacles and stuff on the ship. So this was probably a death sentence. That's when everybody mutinied. They'd had enough. This guy was terrible. He doesn't care about us. He cares more about the plants than he does us, and so they mutinied. They put Captain Bligh and the people that were loyal to him on a small boat and sent them off. The chances of them surviving was about 25%. There's probably sending them on a death sentence, but they didn't want to just kill them. They weren't murderers. And so they sent him off. Then they turned around, went back to Tahiti, picked up the women they had fallen in love with, made them their brides, and then they set sail. But there's a problem. They couldn't land just about anywhere in the earth. The British Empire was, it ruled the world at the time. And in every port, there was probably Englishmen that would report them, and the penalty for mutiny is death. There was very little fuss about it. You mutinied, you're the guy, you signed up, you mutinied, you're done. Captain Bligh did survive. He did get back. He did report that these guys had mutinied. So they knew that chance was possible. So they were looking for a place that nobody knew about. Well, they happened across Pitcairn Island. Pitcairn Island, when they're looking at the maps, they bumped into it. And they're looking at the maps and said, what island is this? They finally realized it's Pitcairn Island. And on the maps that everybody had during the day, sailing, just trying to figure out where they're going, was displaced, I think it's 25 miles, it may have been as much as 100, but I think it was 25 miles. Well, 25 miles in the ocean is an eternity almost. So the chances of them being found were next to nil, unless someone like them just happened to bump into it. So that's where the book ends. The book ends where they had decided to live on this island and they burned the ship, and the rest of the story is about 100 years later they were discovered. And they found the society there was a utopian society. It's obvious why. They had one person on the ship. His name was Christian. He was the first mate. He was the only one that could read and write. They had one book on the ship, the Captain's Bible. And that's what they taught the men who were illiterate, the women who obviously were illiterate, because they lived in Tahiti. They didn't have any schools there. And, of course, their children. So over the generations, they taught the Bible. Every single one of them obeyed the gospel. And they obeyed the God. They didn't have somebody to teach them there. They just read it. And if we went there during that time, we wouldn't find one difference between them. They were baptized for remission of sins. They believed in, you know, following God's law and helping each other. They hadn't, when they were finally discovered 100 years later, there was zero crime. They didn't have a jail. A lot of old societies, they used to have a tree with a chain where they chain up prisoners because they didn't want to build a jail. They didn't have that. They had zero crime. And the people that found them were just amazed at that. But that is the power of God's word. That's the power of what Christ teaches us in the New Testament, how to treat each other, how to love each other, how to act in society. And if we could do that, we'd have a utopian society. Unfortunately, you know, except for here maybe, we don't have much of a utopian society to live in. But that is the power of God's word. There's not another book in history written by man that has that kind of power to be able to build that kind of society. So again, that's just something I thought was interesting to use as an example of the power of God. Oh, I did something. There we go. That's the end of my lesson. And I'm assuming we're given an invitation. Is that right? Okay. Like I say, I think a lot of you probably are Christians. You probably don't need this. Hopefully it will strengthen your faith a little bit. Hopefully it will give you a foundation. But it gives you a chance to start talking to somebody else. But all of us, none of us are perfect. I wish I could say I was, but my wife reminds me constantly I'm not. She really does keep me on the straight and narrow. But all of us have problems, and some are much bigger than others. So this is an opportunity, if you wanted to come down and get the prayers of the elders, the deacons, the men of the church here, to get a little, get God on your side. Put yourself before God's throne and allow the prayers. Prayers are very powerful. Prayers are extremely powerful. If you want some prayers, you can come forward. If you happen to be here and you're not a Christian, I'm not sure this was enough to convince you that the design, that there is a God, that the Bible is true. But if there is somebody here that was maybe waffling on that and you want to talk more about it, you can come down the front. Or if you don't want to come down the front, you can talk to anybody here at any time. But this is an opportunity for those in need to come down while we stand and sing.